The construction industry in Indiana has depended on Quality Supply and Tool, a local family-owned business, to deliver quality sales and service over the last 25 years. The employees make the difference, like sales expert Nick Worley.
What sets us apart is we only offer quality tools and supplies from quality manufacturers. We have a quality trained sales and service staff knowledgeable of the products we sell and offer. Quality. It's in our name.
On South Harding Street in Indy, plus Bloomington and Jeffersonville, Quality Supply and Tool thinks outside the box. Store.
Only the best run here at the Indianapolis 500.
Mario, who do you feel you'll have to beat in this year's race?
People like A.J. Foyt and Bobby Unser, for instance.
Stand by for the checkered flag.
Absolutely incredible. Danny Sullivan spun in front of Mario Andretti.
A.J. has done it.
Beyond the Bricks with jQuery and Mike Thompson. Brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store on 93.5 and 107.5. The Fan.
And we are inside the Hensley Legal Group Race Command Center. It happens. Hire Hensley. jQuery along with Mike Thompson. Landon Coons is the producer who is putting together Beyond the Bricks for us this evening, and this is, if you have come to be a listener of this program of any regularity over the handful of years, and it is still remarkable to think that this is year number five in doing this program. But there are a couple of, and let me give you a glimpse behind the curtain, so to speak, a couple of glimpses as to what makes this show a possibility. First, this program is put together and assembled here inside of Monument Circle, as I mentioned, at the Hensley Legal Group Race Command Center. And the first thing that is important towards making it happen is you have to have people that are willing to come in as producers, because I can't speak for Mike. He is far more technically inclined than myself. I have one skill set in life, presumably, and that's to talk. I'm not saying I do it well. And I can push buttons on and off. That's it. It requires to having people that are willing to come in and put together all kinds of audio and then edit for us in a post-production standpoint or in a live production standpoint, keeping the clock. And Landon, who is a graduate of the University of Indianapolis, has been remarkably doing that for the vast majority of this season of Beyond the Bricks, which is greatly appreciated. Without Landon doing that, this would not be possible. Also, to listeners who listen to this program, enjoy it, and have an appreciation, as do Mike and I, just for the history of the Indianapolis 500-mile race, it becomes important. And the most critical element of all of this is someone like Mike Thompson, who has not only an incredible audio archive of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, but an incredible ability to navigate said archive, put together said archive, and create the kind of tidbits about the archive that we then share with everybody on this show. And this particular episode of Beyond the Bricks, I guess, kind of puts all of that together, because it allows us to showcase and talk about one of Mike's biggest passions. Because I know that this race and all that you hear on this show are the passion of the listeners, but memorabilia in general and things that allow us to remember all of the backstories of the 500, the races of yesteryear, the Landon Coons that are behind the scenes, the people like Mike and myself that get the recognition that actually is the work of other people, the everything from probably cigarette cartons to billboards to magazine articles, all of those things that tie in to the Indianapolis Motor Speedway and the Indianapolis 500 are available, beginning, as a matter of fact, with the memorabilia show that is underway. And Mike, I know this is a labor of love for you, and talking about the memorabilia show in general and everything that goes into it and some of the items that are found there is something that really does perk up for you, because you look forward to this all year long.
I do. It's one of my favorite things of the year. I really look forward to every year. And, I used to be involved with this show. I want to take one second and remember Ted Knorr, who is a very close friend of mine for for decades, more than three decades. And I knew Ted, and Ted passed away a couple months ago. And you know, Ted's a little bit of a member of the IMS Radio Network family, because he's the grandfather of a good friend of both of ours, Nick Yeomans. And we lost Ted a couple months ago, but Ted was very instrumental in, we were involved together in moving the show to the Speedway a few years ago. And we formed a little corporation called MJT, and I was the M and he was the T. And it worked out nice, because I could have been the M or the T, but he was the T in the group. And one of the things he was very, very proud of is that we got the memorabilia show over at the Speedway for a few years. And then the show just outgrew that space, because the show got so popular at the Speedway that we basically ran out of space. So we ended up, the show ended up transferring ownership to a couple other people. Bill DeLong was involved and did an amazing job. And now we got a couple other guys, Kendall Wildman and Craig Huffman, who have taken over, and they do a fabulous job. And the show now is out in Plainfield, out at the Embassy Suites. And it's just, it's a factor, because it's just outgrown the space at the Speedway, and it's just become such a big thing. But you're right. It's something I really look forward to every year, and a 3-day show, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday now. And I couldn't have imagined a few years ago when we moved it. It was a 1-day show at the Speedway, and now it's a 3-day show. I couldn't have imagined that a few years ago.
Well, one of the, if you go back and you look at all of the things that are available at the memorabilia show, one of the things that it teaches you, or one of the things that it doesn't take long to learn, is that the Indianapolis Motor Speedway and the Indianapolis 500 mile race intertwine with so many different areas of business and commerce, certainly the automobile, over the course of years. And it is the labor of love of others well before us that still exist, in letting people know about things that took place out at IMS. For example, the story of Floyd Clymer, who was born just before the turn of the century. I don't mean the millennium century. I mean he was born in 1895. And he worked in a number of different areas, not unlike Carl Fisher, for that matter, in the fact of being a pioneer within sports on two wheels, and then also transitioning that into an interest and a passion and a growth of racing in general, just as a promoter, as a motorcycle manufacturer, and then also in publishing, beginning with publishing pamphlets or books about the engine or the building and the maintenance, the repair of motorcycles, and then eventually becoming the publisher of collectible books about the Indianapolis 500 mile race, the annual yearbooks, if you will. Donald Davidson is one who benefited from that work, being able to read it, research it, have a fire lit within him about his interest in the Indianapolis 500. Donald, of course, now the historian emeritus of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, in his thoughts on the very collectible, still sought to be found at the memorabilia show, Floyd Clymer yearbooks.
I read this review of the Indianapolis 500 yearbook, Floyd Clymer. And so I thought, well, golly, this is terrific. I wanted to know more about that event, and here's a whole book about it. So I read the review, and then next thing that happened was my mother went to London and bought it for a present, because there were a couple of shops in London that would carry such publications. The Floyd Clymer's Indianapolis 500 yearbook wasn't anything that you would find in the town in which I was raised. But there was a couple of specialist shops. So anyway, when she bought that one back, and it just opened up a whole new world for me. So anyway, so for the next few years, and then I found out very quickly that it actually had started with a publication that came out in 1946, which was, I think it was called the 500 History Book, and what it was the best. Clymer did a lot of publications where he did reprints of magazines, and so what basically this book probably was maybe 1% original, and the rest of it was reprints of the best magazine stories for each Indianapolis 500, and sometimes the pre-race stories as well. And so anyway, that book had come out in 46. And it had, like, I don't know, 250 pages or something, 300 pages with a nice thick spine. And after the 46 race, he put out a supplement, which wasn't very big. And then the next year, he put out a larger supplement, and then 48 and 49 were even larger supplements, by which time I think he was calling it the 500 yearbook, but they were staple back, but they kept getting thicker, and then in 1950 it had a staple, a spine. So when I, the first one that I got, and then I found that you could get back issues, so the next time I made a trip up to London, I went to the motor book shop in St. Martin's Lane, and they had several back issues there, but what they didn't have, you could order. So what I would do was every time I saved up a few shillings, I'd send away for a couple more Floyd Climber yearbooks, and they were invaluable to me. So when I finally showed up in 1964, I remember that I was here, I was meeting everybody, and I was invited as a guest to the Old Timers Barbecue, which was a huge honor for me because the membership was very, very tightly controlled in those days. It was drivers who had driven in the 500, 20 years ago or more. They had to be drivers in the race, and you had to be a chief mechanic or an outstanding member of the media or an outstanding official. So rank-and-file people and stooges weren't eligible. The food was served underneath the master control tower, and I saw Floyd Climber standing in line. And I remember this just like it was yesterday, because he was standing there and he was looking at me, and he sort of kind of did a half a smile and then a look away and a look back, and it was almost like a Jack Benny type of thing. And he's probably thinking, who the hell is that young kid with a suit and tie on? Well, I don't know whether anybody had tipped him off, because I had been talking about him, because when I did radio interviews or when I was on the PA, and people said, well, Jim Phillippe on the PA, he said, where did you get all your information? And I said, well, the Floyd Climber yearbook was one of the things. So anyway, I met him later that during that old timers thing. And I don't recall the exact meeting, but I do remember seeing him for the first time standing in the food line with that sort of, bemused expression.
Mike, the reality is that Donald, himself could write probably 1,000 different yearbooks of different things and anecdotes that he knows of the Indianapolis 500. But in the mid-70s, Donald Davidson did do exactly that, Mike.
That's correct. Actually, Donald worked on the Floyd Climber yearbook for a number of years, and actually was going to put out another yearbook for Floyd Climber, and then Floyd Climber unfortunately passed away, and that was sort of the end of the Floyd Climber yearbooks. And then later on, Donald actually put out his own yearbook in 1974 and 1975, and they're very collectible, and they're very well done, as you would expect. I mean, Donald, everything Donald does is first rate, and if you can pick those two up, they're really good. 1974 and 1975, and we had the opportunity through the Talk of Gasoline Alley to hear Donald talk about how he put those together and why he decided to do his own yearbook.
It was a lot of work. 74 and 75 were the 2 years. I talked with a couple of fellows locally about doing one for 1973. So 70, we didn't do one. 71, 72. In 71 or 2, there was a publication that was sort of patterned after the yearbook. And this is, again, it's more of an answer than you wanted. But I was pretty far along, I thought, with doing one in 1973. And then we found out that Carl Hungus was doing one as well. And it was going to be a little confusing, because one was going to be the 500 yearbook and the other one was going to be the Indianapolis Speedway Annual or something like that. And so it ended up that we didn't do one in 73. And then the Carl Hungus series started in 73 and then went all the way through to 97, I think was the last one. And anyway, so I did the 1974 and 75 books. And then in 1976, I wasn't able to do it because, and this is a very long and bold story, but I was working for the United States Auto Club, and I had the opportunity of a lifetime, I had the opportunity of many lifetimes, to be an official on a USAC-sanctioned run, which required me being out of the country for about 3 months. Anyway, because we were gone 3.5 months, I thought, I can't do the book again. And as luck would have it, if you like, the race was rain shortened and it only went halfway anyway. And so thank you for the comments on the 74-75 book. Put a lot of effort into those two things, and I'm very proud of them. I mean, I take them down occasionally and have a look through and think, yeah, not bad, not bad.
Mike, I've always felt when it comes to books and memorabilia, you know, people will ask me, as a matter of fact, this past winter, I was at one of the big bookstores in Indianapolis picking up a Christmas gift, and another customer walks up to me, says, hey, quick question. And I said, okay. And he said, I'm actually looking for a book about the Indianapolis 500 to give to a family member. What would you suggest? And the first thing that came to mind, of course, it wasn't readily available on a bookshelf right here in 2024 at that time in Indianapolis. But the first thing that came to mind that I have always felt, now you may disagree, Mike, but I've always felt like kind of the Holy Grail Bible of books on the early years of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway is 500 Miles to Go, which was written by a very famous book from Al Blumker. And for those that are not familiar, Blumker, which we're going to hear from, talked about the book. But Mike, for those that are unfamiliar, tell us about the book and set up for us what we're about to hear.
Yeah, Al Blumker came out with 500 Miles to Go. He was director of publicity at the Speedway, and he wrote a book, this book, 500 Miles to Go, and it's a very good book, except the one thing you have to do is you have to suspend belief a little bit at the beginning, because it has a bunch of made-up quotes, basically, quotes that were supposedly from Carl Fisher, you know, riding with Lem Trotter in an automobile heading out to look at the farm that would become the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, you know, property. And there's all these quotes, throughout the early portion of the book that clearly are made up. And so you have to understand that those quotes aren't actually real quotes. But if you get past that, there's a lot of really important history in that book. So I agree with you. It's one of the key books of the early era of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway.
In 1961, Freddie Agabashian and Al Blumker talked about the book, 500 Miles to Go.
By the way, I'm reading your new book, 500 Miles to Go. That's terrific. How long did it take you to write it?
Well, the writing job wasn't so bad, Freddie. I wrote it in about 11 months, but I spent 6 years of research before I wrote that first word.
Well, I'll bet the researching must have been a terrific and unusual and interesting job.
It was. I found out a lot of things I never even suspected about this place.
I'll bet you did. Al, by the way, what would you say was the most unusual thing that's happened at the 500?
Well, the most unusual thing happened even before the 500, Freddie. Back in 1910, on July the 4th, Carl Fisher had a five-mile race out here between an airplane and what he called a wind machine, which actually was an overland race car that was powered by a propeller mounted on the rear. There was no drive shaft. It was just like a wingless airplane.
Donald Davidson's thoughts on the book, 500 Miles to Go, from Al Blumker.
And when that book came out, I was a teenager. I won't tell you exactly where, but I was in my, we'll just say my mid-teens. And even then, I remember the motor book shop on St. Martin's Lane in London, very close to Charing Cross Road and just a very short distance from Leicester Square and Trafalgar Square. And that was where I purchased a number of my early Indianapolis 500 year books, and I remember being in there because I was working in London. I went to work in London in May of 61, and the book had just come out. And I remember just picking that thing up, and it was brand spanking new, and I could smell the print and everything. And I remember looking in the back and being a little disappointed on the stats, because it gave the first 10 for each year, and I was wishing that they would have gone deeper. And the other thing was that I was flipping the pages and reading this dialogue in the shop and thinking, well, how do you know this conversation took place exactly like this? How do you know that Carl Fisher said, well, I think we ought to do so and so and so and so and so, and that Arthur Newby said, well, I'll go along with that. How do you know that's going to happen? So, and I've had other people raise that same point, and we don't. I think Plemker just sort of took a little artistic license there and just thought he needed to put in conversation. And I have to say, I don't know, I wouldn't qualify as a professional writer, at least I wasn't a trained professional writer, but whenever I've done a story, I normally don't use quotes. Very rarely do I use quotes, and the only ones that I do use are ones that I've actually seen in print previously or as it was told to me. So, but anyway, that's just all a matter of choice, I suppose.
Mike, what I think is interesting about the book, and I remember when I read it, the book goes back 500 miles to go. It starts in the very early days of when Carl Fisher had the vision or the dream ultimately that it would become the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. And, you know, the going out with Trotter to find the land and riding out and, you know, the process of buying the farms. I do think that it did an excellent job of portraying that picture and being able to make relatable the story, almost fictionalizing like a story to lead up to then what is factually supported statistically. So I do understand, like, almost from the journalistic standpoint, the compromise there. But I thought that from a writing standpoint, it was well done because it made me feel like I could envision and picture being along with those guys in those early days, if that makes sense.
Oh, yeah. No, I understand completely what you're saying. That's a literary device called faction. Brock Yates used that in another book that he did about the 1950s, where he basically played a character in the book that had gone to see the Le Mans tragedy or gone to see Bill Vukovich, the accident that Bill Vukovich had. And basically in the book, throughout the, it was called Against Death and Time. And basically it puts you there with all these different quotes and things like that. But the quotes aren't actually real. So that's like a literary device called faction. And I think if it was presented in that way originally, I think I wouldn't have as much of a problem with the fake quotes. But I think, as you said, it really is a good way to kind of envision how the whole process came together of going out to buy the farm. You can kind of see them on this dusty two-lane road going out to buy the farm. And as soon as he sees the land, the wheels turning in his head that this is the place that I'm going to build this track. So you're right. I mean, it does serve a great purpose, and it's a very good book, and I think everyone should have it in their library for sure.
You know, it was Pink Floyd that said, all in all, it's just another brick in the wall. But when it comes to another brick from the Speedway, those will probably be available at the memorabilia show, but there are things that we need to discuss about it. So we'll do that when we return to Beyond the Bricks.
In the construction business and tired of dealing with the indifference of big corporate suppliers, Quality Supply and Tool on South Harding Street understands. For over 25 years, owner Kevin Anne has had a different approach.
We at Quality Supply and Tool take pride in being a locally owned family business committed to service. And every customer's needs are different, and we truly believe in shaping our business to our customers' needs. That's what separates us from the competition.
That's Quality Supply and Tool, with additional locations in Bloomington and Jeffersonville to serve Hoosiers better. Partner with Quality Supply and Tool and think outside the box store.
Hey all, I'm Jamie Lynn Sigler, a mom, actor, and advocate. I know how overwhelming it can be trying to decide which treatment is right for you. I've been there, but you should know you're not alone. You can do this. Start with some research, talk to the community, and most importantly, don't be afraid to ask your doctor questions. You might find results that speak for themselves. That's how I landed on Kesimpta. Ask your doctor if Kesimpta, ofatumumab, could be right for you. You can check out the details at kesimpta.com.
This is Beyond the Bricks, brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store on 93.5 and 107.5 The Fan.
Breaker 19, this is Sterling Brewmaster. How do I get on that Interstate 64?
Hey, Brewmaster, you trucking Sterling beer?
That's a big 10-4.
Brewmaster, you just got a front door. Imagine, Sterling's here now.
Breaker 19, you said Sterling beer?
Sterling, still brewed with fresh natural ingredients and full natural aging with no shortcuts. And when you brew a beer this good, you just naturally build a following. Sterling, now in 14 states and still growing.
That's how it sounded back in 1978 for Sterling Beer and their Sterling Beer commercials. Inside the Hensley Legal Group Race Command Center, Jake Query, along with Mike Thompson on this episode of Beyond the Bricks. And the Sterling Beer signs, Mike, those are a collectible that probably something one will be able to find at the memorabilia show.
Yeah, absolutely. You'll see the Sterling Beer signs. And I'll tell you that I had a Sterling Beer sign in my bedroom, I think, from the time I was like five, because my dad put one in my room and I didn't know what Sterling beer was. Of course, I was like five, but I liked the flags. It had some neat flags at the top because it had all the, like, the individual flags, you know, the red flag and the checker flag, all those were at the top. But I didn't know at the time what Sterling beer was, but I think I had a Sterling beer sign in my room when I was five.
Parents of the year over there, right?
Yeah. My dad had gave some interesting gifts when I was a kid, for sure.
Which is cool, right? Hey, it was 500 memorabilia, right? I mean,
absolutely. That,
now we know where it all began.
That's right.
But again, those signs, collectible, very, very cool. Donald Davidson's thoughts.
The only connection that they had was that they did that item, I think they did several years. And I can't tell you what the years were. I think 57 is the earliest pay slap shot. It's either the pay slap or the start. And I think they went up into maybe 64 or 65 and possibly every year. That's about all I remember, except that when 1964 was my first year, and I remember on a black and white TV seeing the Sterling Beer commercial, which was Boots Randolph and Doc Severinsen. I don't know if anybody remembers that one or not, but they never sponsored a car. As far as I know, it was just that sign.
Now, if you want to, I don't know, maybe like get a better workout instead of carrying out a sign, you want something a little heavier, maybe do a little, a couple of curls on your way to the car, then perhaps a Speedway brick is the thing for you. There were 3.2 million of them approximately that became the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. And there are some bricks that could be available. But if you are getting an official Speedway brick, there's a caveat that we'll tell you about after we hear from Donald Davidson about the bricks.
But I know that there's been a number of claims from over in Ohio, almost at the West Virginia border, about that's where the bricks came from. The bricks came, for the most part, from Petersburg, Indiana. About 90% of them were Cover blocks. There were a couple of other companies, or a couple of other brand names, I should say, that came out of that same kiln or set of kilns. When they had the order to fill approximately 3,200,000 bricks, they couldn't fill the entire order they had a bunch of millions of bricks, or several, a couple of million bricks in stock, but they couldn't complete the full order, so they had to go to some surrounding places. And what I understand, there's five different companies involved. There may be up to 16 different types of bricks, but they came, the 90% are from Petersburg. They also, there's some from Brazil. There's the Marion paver, which has been in print as being from Marion, Indiana. It was the Marion pavers came from Montezuma, and then I think Attica, Crawfordsville, and maybe Terre Haute. But anyway, that's the majority of the all of the bricks came from that same general area.
Mike, lots of people out there that have bricks, but I'm going to let you play Mythbuster here. Go ahead with your riff of a myth, if you will, about the bricks.
Well, what you have to remember about the bricks is, as you mentioned, there's 3.2 million bricks were used in the creation of the Speedway. More than 90% of them are still underneath the surface. So there's not, it's not like 3.2 million hit the market or anything like that. Most of them are still there underneath the asphalt. the different layers of asphalt. But what I want to tell people about it is we have so many people come up to us at the memorabilia show and say, well, okay, I've got a Culver block. That must mean it's from the Speedway. Not necessarily. You know, Culver blocks were used in churches. They were used in one-room schoolhouses. They were used in all kinds of building, you know, products over the years. So because you have one of the bricks that was used in the paving of the Speedway does not mean it's necessarily a Speedway brick. It could be from anything. The only way really to tell it came from the Speedway is to get it from the Speedway. The second best way is if it has some mortar still on it from the use in the Speedway. You know, that's a good clue that it could be a real Speedway brick. You know, we see a lot of those that have mortar still attached to them. That's a good clue that it's an actual Speedway brick. But if you found a Speedway, you know, a Culver block, and you know, that's one of the bricks or a post-in or one of the, you know, Brazil blocks or something like that, just because it's a brick that was used in the Speedway, that doesn't mean it's a Speedway brick. You know, so that's one of the caveats I want people to understand about the bricks. It's something that, you know, we talk to people about the bricks every year at the Memorabilia Show.
So perhaps if the brick issue becomes too tricky for you, you want something safer, then you're like, you know what, I'll get one of the die-cast cars. Well, not necessarily die-cast cars as we know them today, but the predecessors thereof, the so-called Wilbur Shaw cars. Donald Davidson on Clabber Girl and the Shaw cars.
All right, I can tell you a little bit about those. They were based on Wilbur Shaw's Maserati, although very loosely based on Wilbur Shaw's Maserati. And I think it was around 1948 or 49, I believe. It was a company in Illinois, just not very far from Terre Haute, as I recall, just over the border. And originally they were not for sale, and there were three different versions. There was the one that says Indianapolis Motor Speedway along each side. And then I think there's another one that has Wilbur Shaw's signature, except, of course, I mean, it's inlaid into the metal. And then there's red painted at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway version. It's red lettering painted into, I don't know if indented would be the term. And then there's the Wilbur Shaw version. And then the other one that's harder to find is Clabber Girl. So they had the three. They gave them away, I believe. I don't think they were originally for sale. And then at some point, then they did become available for sale, and when I first ran into this, because I was at the museum, it slowed down a little bit, but 3, 4, or 5 years ago, I was probably hearing, I'd say at least maybe, you know, 10, 12 a year where these things would pop up and people thought they had a gold mine. If it was in good condition, if you had an original and it was, you know, excellent condition and still in the box, and there's the key phrase, I think they were worth like about $300, $350. But, of course, many of them were not in good shape because kids had played with them out in the sandbox and the tires were missing. Some people had painted them. I saw one that was painted orange. And anyway, at some point, I had a lady call one time, and she was asking me, she was trying to identify the name of a driver, and it was somebody I'd never heard of, and then it turned out that she had one of these cars, and it had a name that had been etched into the car. And investigating a little bit further, it turns out that probably in like 54, 55, somewhere in there, at the Indiana State Fairgrounds, there was a fellow that had these things for sale, and he had this tool that you could, it was like an engraving tool. And so you'd buy the car for $1.50 or $2 or whatever it was, which was not inexpensive at that time. And then they would etch in the name of your choice. So the Speedway decided to replicate them. And was that last year or the year before, I think?
And when you talk about memorabilia or anything that takes you back in time, nostalgia, etc., a lot of what you're talking about, there is a time where it was actually current and there was no memorabilia. There weren't necessarily souvenirs. So with that, Donald Davidson on the topic of just souvenirs in the history of them at the Speedway.
The Speedway did very little of that type of thing, and I don't know that they really would have an opportunity to sell souvenirs because they didn't have a museum until 1956. And then when they did, it was just like a little corner of the museum with a couple of glass cases and maybe one lady there to service the whole thing. And so the most of the souvenirs would be out on 16th Street and up Georgetown Road. But it used to be heavy on 16th Street. And sometime in about 83, 84, 85, they decided to, to start protecting their interests, IMS. And that is that they then, the Speedway Police went down and issued warnings to people that actually were not selling licensed goods. And I do remember on TV, there was one fellow said, because they were selling what they were official souvenirs that were not official souvenirs. Mm-hmm. And I think this one fellow said, well, I've been doing this since 1949, so I really can't kick. And so he was selling all this stuff that was, that said official souvenirs and all that kind of stuff. And they weren't. In fact, early on, there were bogus programs. And people would sort of get the entry list and then put out a bogus program. In fact, the collectors, they actually pay quite a lot, just like buying a bootleg.
Yeah.
Mike, I should have asked, by the way, going back a couple minutes, do you own a brick?
I do. I've got a couple bricks that came directly from my late friend, Jack McKenzie, who you would see in a lot of the Victory Lane shots because he was the one who put the trophy on the back of the winning car from 1953 to 1982. So I got a couple bricks from him. So I'm pretty convinced that those are legitimate bricks and they have the mortar on them as well. So
I've got one and a half. Now, if I have a half brick, but it's covered in mortar, can we declare that that is, in fact, probably at least remnant of a brick?
Yeah, I think that's probably a remnant of a brick. But Donald brings up an interesting point, by the way, in that last clip we heard about souvenirs, talking about the fact that there were so many bootlegs early on, because the programs, that's one of the reasons if you see the early programs that say pay no more on the front of the program, the reason that said that was because of the fact that they were basically people were just making their own programs and they would sell you a program outside the gates of the Speedway, but it was something they just created on their own. So, there were a lot of souvenirs like that, that were sold in the early days that they were just people just made them themselves. So those are actually very highly collectible, what they're called, the so-called bootleg programs.
Back in the day, as the kids used to say, KTEL, Ronco, there were several of them that would make compilation music records of songs of the era. It wasn't music records that were the rage when it comes to the memorabilia show now today that hailed from the early to mid-70s, but rather those with the voice of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. We'll explain when we return to Beyond the Bricks.
The construction industry in Indiana has depended on Quality Supply and Tool, a local family-owned business, to deliver quality sales and service over the last 25 years. The employees make the difference, like sales expert Nick Worley.
What sets us apart is we only offer quality tools and supplies from quality manufacturers. We have a quality trained sales and service staff knowledgeable of the products we sell and offer. Quality. It's in our name.
On South Harding Street in Indy, plus Bloomington and Jeffersonville, Quality Supply and Tool thinks outside the box. Store.
Hey all, I'm Jamie Lynn Sigler, a mom, actor, and advocate. I know how overwhelming it can be trying to decide which treatment is right for you. I've been there. But you should know you're not alone. You can do this. Start with some research, talk to the community, and most importantly, don't be afraid to ask your doctor questions. You might find results that speak for themselves. That's how I landed on Kesimpta. Ask your doctor if Kesimpta, ofatumumab, could be right for you. You can check out the details at kesimpta.com.
This is Beyond the Bricks, brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store on 93.5 and 107.5 The Fan.
Now you can relive again the Indy 500 from 1911 through Victory Lane with a brand new 90-minute, 33 1/3 stereo LP record album. The exciting highlights over the years from our actual radio broadcasts. Everything from Gentlemen Start Your Engines through the checkered flag with the voices of the men who've made history here. Send your name and address to Great Moments, Indianapolis Motor Speedway, Speedway, Indiana, 46224. Send $5 in cash, check, or money order for the album, $6 for 8-track cartridge or cassette. We pause 10 seconds now for station identification. This is the Indianapolis Motor Speedway Network.
Well, thank you, Sid. Station identification simply says it's Beyond the Bricks with Jake Query, Mike Thompson inside the Legal Hensley Group Race Command Center. You just heard it, the ad for the 1975 LP, Great Moments from the Indy 500. Donald Davidson on those albums.
That was a really enjoyable experience because the script was written by a fellow named Ron Dorson, who I've kept in contact with. He wrote several books, and he's living in Las Vegas now. But anyway, it was made in Revere, Massachusetts by Fleetwood Records, and Sid asked me if I would go with him. So I think it was probably, it was 75 when the record came out, so it must have been probably January or February of 1975. I flew with Sid up to Boston, and then we went to this studio, and I think we were there like 2 or 3 days. And what he had done was he had what they call actualities. He had this wish list of everything that he thought should be in there, and they had dubbed off locally like 1 and 2 minute bits sometimes, or 30 seconds, and which was way too long. I mean, the record could have been, you know, 4 or 5 hours, but they had to make it 45 minutes aside because they had this special thing called the Dyna Groove. I mean, it was a really, really tiny little groove, so you could get about 40 to 45 minutes on each side of the LP. But the really hard part was listening to all of the excerpts up there, like Victory Lane,
right,
and just picking out one line of Vukovich or Pat Flaherty or whoever,
right,
else. I said, I wish we could use the whole thing.
Yeah.
But it was just, it was fantastic to sit with Sid and help edit the thing. It was just a very, very enjoyable experience.
One of the really cool items each and every year at the Memorabilia Show, and we'll have Mike give you all the information on the Memorabilia Show here in just a minute, are the pith helmets. Some of them are signed, some of them are not, but all of them are cool. Donald Davidson on those.
Those are called pith helmets, and it was the safety patrol is what they called them. From the time the track opened up until 1947, all of the events were policed by the Indiana National Guard. And after Tony Holman purchased the track, and a number of the old guard upon either intended or not intended there, they decided, you know what, we could do this ourselves. So we think it's in 1948 is when the safety patrol was formed, with many of the same people, and a lot of police, and ex-police, and somebody had a bunch of these pith helmets, P-I-T-H, and it's the kind that you would wear on safari, and for a number of years that was the headgear. The outfits were blue wool, which were extremely hot. They had to wear a light blue tie. Why you would have the top button up and a tie on, I have no idea. They were hotter than blazes. If it rained, then the wool soaked up the water and your shirt weighed 30 pounds. And nobody liked those outfits, but the pith helmets were part of it, and they didn't get replaced until it was about probably 1970 or 71 is when they went over to the yellow shirts, short sleeves, and the baseball caps. Or actually, they started with a thing called bump. I think they were called them bump helmets. It was like a batting helmet that they had for a couple of years. They were plastic, golden colored, and they would have their name
on a piece of tape across the front of the thing. But anyway, it was the pith helmets went from, so 48 until about 70, 71, and the heads of department were gold, and the rank and file, which numbered many hundreds on race day and qualifying days, were silver. And they eventually ran out of them because the guards would take them home for souvenirs. But anyway, that was it. Those were gone by 72, 73. I don't think they were around anymore.
Mike, I wanted to give you the opportunity again here to kind of rehash in the last 45 seconds or so just about the Memorabilia Show, why it's special to you, and how people can get a chance to enjoy it this year.
Yeah, it's Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at the Embassy Suites in Plainfield. And it's 3 to 8 on Thursday, 3 to 7 on Friday on Carb Day, and 9 to 4 on Saturday. And there's going to also be some driver autograph sessions. I know Ari Leyendijk is going to be there with his new book. Stefan Gregoire is going to be there, Emerson Fittipaldi, Mel Kenyon, Donnie Beecho, and there's going to be more autograph guests to come as well from there. So, and that's at the Embassy Suites on Perry Road in Plainfield. It's a great time to meet, you know, people who have similar interests as yourself, and talk to people who are interested in the race, interested in collecting. And we have information on the 500 Collectors Club. I'm the vice president, one of the two vice presidents of the National Indy 500 Collectors Club. So if you're interested in that, we can get you signed up for that as well. So it's just a really good time out there.
A lot of fun, a lot of people with similar passion, similar interest. And no matter what your interest might be, a brick, a book, a helmet, a sticker, you name it, they've got it at the Memorabilia Show. Certainly appreciate everybody listening tonight to Beyond the Bricks.
Imagine that first scoop feeling with Hudsonville ice cream. Your favorite ice cream flavors taste just right. Are you reaching for Traverse City cherry fudge, brownie batter cookie dough, super scoop? No matter which flavor is your favorite, every bite of Hudsonville ice cream is real ice cream made the way it's meant to be, creamy and delicious. Some ice creams are good. Your favorite from Hudsonville is irresistible. This summer, scoop, savor, and repeat all your favorite Hudsonville ice cream flavors. Visit HudsonvilleIceCream.com to find your favorite near you.